So shit shows, the holidays sure do sneak up fast, so it's never too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it instead of scrambling at the last minute and just finding whatever the hell you can find. And Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Good looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. So I just got a friend of mine a laptop cat scratch. Scratching pad. So it's a scratching pad that looks like a laptop because her cat, like mine, likes to constantly sit on her computer. It's probably not going to help with that problem, but it was hilarious and I had to get it. And then I got for myself, it's called a couch caddy. So confession, I'm constantly losing my phone and the remote in between the couch cushions. And so this is this like beautiful wooden thing that kind of drapes over the arm of the couch. And it has a designated spot where I can put my phone, the remote, a drink. It's the shit. I'm obsessed. And so Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms to dads, kids, teens, book lovers, history buffs, diehard football fans to foodies. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else, and I mean it. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/adultchild. That's uncommongoods.com/adultchild for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. When being yourself feels dangerous, you learn to become whoever keeps you safe. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of a dysfunctional family. And the chances are that you are as well, if you've somehow found yourself here, if you've somehow stumbled on in. And this is where we talk about what the hell to do about that. We curse here, you've been warned. So today we are diving deep with returning guest, therapist, fan fave, someone who I have deemed the queen of fawning, Miss Ingrid Clayton. So she's got a new book out. It came out about a month ago. It is called Fawning: How the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. I know many of y'all on the shit show have already read this. I've heard nothing but raving reviews. I've read it myself. It's a banger. And so is this interview. So for anyone who may not be familiar with fawning is what CPTSD expert Pete Walker calls the fourth F. So we have fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. And this is what happens when neither fighting or fleeing are options. So your body learns to survive by appeasing the threat instead. And this response is the most viable option for us as kids. When you're dependent on the very people who are causing you harm, being good, being helpful, trying to stay invisible can feel like the only way to stay safe. And in many respects, it is, right? Because we can't fight, we can't flee, we gotta fawn. And we see this riddled all throughout the laundry list. The majority of the laundry list traits are fawn responses. We became approval seekers. We're frightened by angry people or any personal criticism. We have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. We feel guilty standing up for ourselves. And so this interview is not your basic bitch convo on fawning. This is a deep, raw look at how fawning actually shows up in real life, in parenting, in sex, in friendships, with yourself. Let's get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. The holiday season is here. It is staring us right in the face. And as we all know, this can be a very difficult time of the year. Lots of triggers, lots of shit to navigate. So if you are looking for some additional support, you do not have to fare this holiday season alone. You can be amongst others who truly get it for less than $1 a day. Less than $1 a day. That is quite the steal, if you ask me. So you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, the person who right now in their head is thinking, she's talking about me. I know she's talking about you. Yes, I am talking about you. Okay. Damn the join. See the link in the show notes, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. Next, give me a little follow on Insta, on TikTok. You can watch this interview on YouTube, youtube.com/@adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all.
She's back. Author of now of 2 books, Miss Ingrid Clayton, who I'm deeming the queen of fawning.
And I am wearing that crown rather proudly. Thank you.
So the book comes out tomorrow.
Yes.
And what I wanted to ask you was, and folks, she already said nobody asked her this question before, so I'm just going to say that again. We were chatting before we started recording, and she said that I was asking her if she enjoys writing, and she said that through writing, she's able to gain deeper insights into yourself. So I wanted to know what came up for you in writing this book. Were there any big ahas?
Yes. And I think one of the biggest takeaways for me, you know, so my personal experience of needing to live in a chronic fawn response was out of childhood trauma, right? So that's just my lived experience. And
is
then
it
when
ever
I
not?
Yeah. Which so I'll speak to some of the other context, which was really sort of profound for me to see when you sort of widen that lens or pull back and you look beyond just the family system, how many systems of power are so many of us living in and navigating day in and day out, right? So you look at communities, you look at religion, like, you know, culture and politics and all these things, and really any marginalized community, any community that is disempowered or any community where you don't hold all the power is ripe for a fawn response. And so as I was looking at my experiences, you know, I'll be honest and I'll say even in terms of people of color or people in LGBTQ communities, which I do not identify in either case, I felt more of a connection to those marginalized communities than maybe I ever had before. Mm-hmm. I could see the connective tissue in our experiences. So in a way, it really sort of broadened my sense of empathy and compassion in ways that were profound for me, right? It was sort of like it dropped me even deeper into the human condition and the human condition where I'm living amongst all these other humans who, in some way, you know, we have more similar experience than we may even realize.
That's interesting because I guess it's all those other things are like trauma in a sense, but maybe not relational trauma. But I wonder if the fawn response it's always a nervous system thing. Like if one could develop that from experiencing trauma like later on in life and having yes. not experienced that during their upbringing.
Yes. So I say absolutely. And for me, I think complex trauma or synonymous with relational trauma, it just depends on how you're defining relationship, right? Your relationship to your environment is relational. Your mm-hmm. relationship to your community, right? Like, oh my gosh, my community holds my whole world. And yet I can't really be my whole self in order to belong. There's this double bind that exists typically with the fawn response. And I think it's also why many of us are primed and conditioned to be fawners, whether that's in our childhood or in the workplace, for instance, right? There are these perpetual hierarchies, and the body just intuitively knows, right? It's almost in relation, the relationship in this case is my relationship to the hierarchies in which I reside day in, day out. And my body knows where I exist in that pecking order. And that if I am not at the top, right? So we can say to someone like, well, just have a voice, right? Just speak up for yourself or set boundaries. It's like, that is not available to me. There will be dire consequences if I do. And, you know, enter the fawn response from stage left. It's like, the body knows that these other things are not available or would make it worse, you know? So I really think this understanding of the larger context that not only support fawning, but quite frankly, expect it was powerful for me to see.
It's really interesting. Yeah, it really broadens the brush, which is good for you. More readers.
That's true. Right? Sadly, but yes, from a publishing standpoint, I guess it's good.
Yeah. So last time we talked about your journey of realizing how much your childhood impacted you. And I want to kind of take that same question, but from the lens of fawning. And I remember you sharing that, you know, for a long time, you thought that you were struggling with codependency. Mm. And then to eventually realize that this really was the fawn trauma response. Yeah. And so I'm curious what that journey of realizing that looked like.
It's such a good question. It's hard to kind of pinpoint in a way, but I can say that over time, that distinction for me became very important, right? That I never quite saw my whole self reflected in the terminology of either codependency or people pleasing. And so the more that I have understood the fawn response, explored it, unpacked it in this way, the more freedom I have found, the more I have made sense to myself, the more that I see how, A, my body is hardwired for safety and survival. Fawning comes on without my conscious awareness. It's not a choice. It's a reflex, right? I make sense, in other words, right? And I think when we look historically at certainly the original definitions of codependency and, you know, people pleasing, they are steeped in this idea that you're a problem and you're broken and you're a control freak and what's wrong with you? Like, knock it off already. They're steeped in this, a ton of shame and even the idea that we have a disease, right? So we are dysfunctional. In other words, fawning to me places these behaviors not only back in our body, which, like I said, we're hardwired for these instincts, but back into the environments in which we're navigating. So I'm not dysfunctional. I'm responding in a very healthy and adaptive way to dysfunctional environments. So just if the listener takes away that one point, you know, I think for most people, they can just feel the shame sort of like running out of their body. It returns us to a sense of agency, which is what we've been seeking our whole lives anyway, right? I can finally belong to myself and feel proud of myself because I go, I'm not dysfunctional. I don't have a disease. I'm not broken. I, in fact, it's not a self-esteem problem. That's the other piece of it. Mm-hmm. I, in fact, love myself so much that my body intuitively was like threading this very fine needle of all these other responses aren't really available for me, but I'm not giving up, right? It's like, it's this last ditch effort almost to say, I'm going to continue to navigate this situation so that I can hopefully come away as unscathed as possible.
Would you ever say that there are instances where people pleasing doesn't qualify as fawning?
It's such a great question and a common one. And I feel like maybe I'm going to get more information down the line because I go, oh, I didn't consider that. But today, as I sit here, I cannot really think of an instance where, I guess if you call people pleasing where you really are engaging in this like conscious brown nosing, sort of like maybe that is a little bit different. It's sort of you're doing it intentionally.
Like where you're playing the game almost.
Yes. But even that, there's like a fine sort of, you know, line between these worlds where I think even with the fawn response, again, if you sort of know, like I'm going into the lion's den, right? Like, maybe there is a more conscious-ish kind of presentation of fawning, but I don't know. I think it's a tricky question. I haven't found like a concrete example where I feel like, aha, this would be people pleasing without any fawn response attached to it. I think the fawn response tends to be the heartbeat of these behaviors.
Yeah, I think just thinking about it out loud, if it's true people pleasing, because I was thinking in the sense of like, I don't know, even like in a business transaction, but yeah. I think that would be more people pleasing, more manipulation masquerading as people pleasing.
Right.
You know?
That's interesting. Yes. I think maybe that's the reason that I haven't been able to sort of say, because when we talk about people pleasing, we're not necessarily talking about conscious manipulation, right? Yeah. we're talking about really just propping other people up and sort of so. But to your point, I think, yes, if you're just talking about strictly conscious manipulation and you're doing it with a smile, that's different. That's different.
Mm. I want you to explain how fawning is a hybrid nervous system response. And it's the only one, right?
Well, it depends on the model that you're working in. So Peter Levine of Somatic Experiencing famously talked about the freeze response also as a hybrid. Mm-hmm. And he explained it this way, which I love, which is that one foot is on the gas, which is essentially fight flight energy, but one foot is on the brake, right? Which is this down regulation, frozen experience. So there's in the freeze response, there's a lot of activation like you experience in fight or flight, but it's just that it's frozen. The brake is containing it where you can't do anything with it. That's that deer in the headlights presentation, right? So that contains both hyperarousal and hypoarousal at the same time. So fawning is similar. We have one aspect that is we're mobilized, right? There's the adrenaline, we're showing up, we're hypervigilant, we're noticing, we're managing the moods and the states of those around us. But the hypoarousal is the part that disconnects from self, right? It's the reason that in almost all the signs and symptoms for fawning include some level of self-abandonment. And ultimately, this is because the body has to choose in this double bind, right? Am I going to choose safety and survival, or am I going to choose, like, you know, access to my fullest, highest self? The body will always choose safety and survival. So that's the current understanding in terms of it being a hybrid presentation, right? So you're not actively making it worse by fighting back or running, particularly you think about children. Those options are not available to us. But you're also not going all the way towards what we call a submit or collapse response. That's what we see, particularly in the animal kingdom, where the animal just plays dead, right? It's this last ditch effort. And it's different from freeze. That's why I say it depends on the model that you're referring to, because some people equate the two. But I actually like the differentiation that freeze, there is all of that adrenalized, you know, racing heartbeat going on. With submit, it's a playing dead because there's no muscle tone. The body goes limp, right? Mm. Different from a freeze response where there's this rigidity, that deer in headlights. Submit is like literally you could be scooped up in the claws of the animal and the prey animal. The animal thinks it's dead, right? And hopefully it sets it down long enough that that little prey animal can kind of scamper away. But it's a completely numb feeling. And so fawning is kind of in the middle of those two poles. We're not fighting back. We're not running. We're not making it worse. We also have to show up day in and day out, right? So there's this hybrid presentation that looks different depending on the context, but tends to have both of these flavors happening at the same time.
So I'm assuming you heard about fawning when you read Pete Walker's book for the first time, right?
Well, actually, I heard about it when I was writing my memoir, and maybe even previous to that, writing something for Psychology Today. I was not aware of Pete Walker's work, and I was unpacking these same themes, right? Sort of going on my own path, like, why aren't we talking about this experience? I knew there was something there, and so I was articulating it.
When you mean this experience, what do you mean? Like, well, these behaviors and having it not fall under the category of codependency or what?
Yes, correct. Yes. Particularly as it relates to sexual fawning, I think that was being missed. There were just aspects that I was talking about, writing about, and someone who read what I had written said, this reminds me of Pete Walker's work. Have you heard of him? And I said, no. Mm. And so, of course, I ran and immediately saw myself reflected in fawning. And it was one of the major puzzle pieces that I got from writing my own story. So not just reclaiming what happened to me, right? Validating it myself, not waiting for anyone else to validate it. But once I did that, once I could see that, yes, my experience was complex trauma, and this is where I lived for decades after the fact, in this chronic fawn response, coming online, whether I was safe or not, right? My body wasn't going to wait to find out. It changed my life, essentially. And it's changed my clients' lives. And that's why this more deeper, specific dive on fawning, because it's kind of been the trauma response that's hiding in plain sight. It hasn't received nearly the attention that it deserves. So I'm thrilled to be able to sort of take the magnifying glass now, both on my story. There are aspects of my story in there too, but I needed to broaden that and show a diverse set of experiences, how fawning can look different, right? Depending on who you are and the context that you're in. And
well, it probably is the most prevalent of the responses. When we look at the laundry list traits of an adult child, I mean, right, those are all fawning. Oh. This is probably the fawn response is what causes us the most pain, I would say, 95% of the time, right?
Wow, that's powerful what you're saying. And I would imagine that it's true. You know, the thing that saved us ultimately, the thing that helped us adapt and survive these environments becomes the thing that's keeping us stuck and small and in our own way. Yeah.
Was this something that, like, because you're talking about just, this was something that you were unpacking. Was this an aspect about yourself that, like, you couldn't wrap your brain around? Was this something that you felt like, I don't know, you were trying to work through for a long time and, like, you just couldn't figure out why you were the way you were?
Yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. And let's be real, I wasn't just doing it on my own. I've sat on a lot of therapist couches over the years, right? I'm now 51 years old. I dedicated my life essentially to trying to unpack some of these things. No one ever named my experiences as trauma or complex trauma. And certainly no one put my responses in the context of trauma. And part of that is the fact that we're only just now, you know, we didn't know some of these things even when I was in graduate school. But some of it is that I think even the mental health field now is not up to speed, right? It's like, as you know, complex PTSD, still not in the DSM, like, you know, all of these challenges that we face to kind of legitimize our experiences, to give it concrete language and ways in, it's been a bit maddening. And so, yes, everything I've done my whole life, including ultimately going to graduate school and getting 3 degrees in psychology and going to all these trauma trainings, all of it has ultimately been in service of, why do I still feel so stuck? Because I have earnestly tried, right? It's like I read all those books. I did all the workshops. You know what I mean? How long am I going to have to sit here and meditate? When am I finally going to be relieved of this feeling that I'm stuck, that my relationships are not healthy? I know that there's more for me out there, and yet I cannot access it. And this work is the work that has finally freed me.
It's beautiful.
It's so big.
It is huge. It was really interesting for me to listen back to our first conversation just because of everything I've been through and learned since then. And especially from, like, I've started doing parts work since then, which I do want to get into parts work. But before we get into all that, a couple of questions. So one of the things that you talked about was how, for some people, fawning shows up as being more of yourself, like bringing out more of yourself, versus for some people, it's about being less of yourself.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you could speak to that and if you have noticed any sort of patterns as far as what would cause one to go one way or the other.
Yeah.
And is it typically, like, are you seeing people vacillate between both, or do people tend to stick on one side of the spectrum?
Yeah, I'd say it's both, because some people stay on one side of the spectrum. Some are in different contexts that elicit a different response. And so then it shifts. But ultimately what you're saying is, yes, so fawning sometimes looks like an overfunctioning. And that tends to originate from experiences of neglect or abandonment, right? Maybe emotional immaturity or generational trauma. Basically, your needs were not being met. And so part of the response then, the adaptive response, is to go, Well, then I'm just going to do everything I can possibly do to meet all my own needs. And maybe if I help you with yours too, you're eventually going to come online and we can kind of do this together. So there's this sense that, like, not only do I have to soak up all the shame and the dysfunction, kind of like metabolize it through my own body, because no one else is going to be doing their own work, but I also have to be responsible for all the things, everyone's emotional well-being, right? There is just this, like, I have to be bigger because you are essentially absent, okay? On the other end of that equation, where you might sort of say we're under-functioning or we're not bringing as much of ourselves, it's that feeling of, and I would say too, that I kind of call that first side of the spectrum is like the caretaking side. The over-functioning tends to be synonymous with the caretaking side. This other side, it tends to be the appeasement side, right? So here we tend to lean on this when it feels like we're being attacked, someone's moving in, we are not safe, there's overt abuse happening to us. And even as I'm doing this with my hand, there's this sort of closing in. I have to get smaller in order to survive it. Oh my God, your needs matter so much more than mine. I can't even hardly exist in this equation, but I have to remind you that I'm still a person and you like me, don't you? So in this case, getting bigger or even right-sized, like occupying your full self and agency, would feel threatening because you're moving against the source of the aggression, right? In other words, it's like you don't have an access to a healthy fight response of having a voice and taking up space and setting boundaries. The way to survive was in getting small. So getting bigger, or like I said, occupying just your own God-given right to exist in the world, feels terrifying. It feels like you become a bigger target.
Yeah, so that fear of being seen.
That's right. Yeah, the fear of being seen. So, you know, in both of these presentations, you go, well, gosh, they're so different. But ultimately, we're still managing the gap between who we are and what's happening in the environment. It's just whatever that environment necessitates is what the body's going to shape shift into, right? Who do I need to be in order to navigate this situation? And that's why it can shift depending on context.
Can fawning show up, like, even when we're not having an interaction with another person? Does it show up just in our relationship with ourselves?
All right, Chichos, did you know that scientists now openly say that your gut is the cornerstone of your health? And it's not just about digestion, okay? The gut literally affects everything from your energy levels to mood to weight management and even your longevity. However, an imbalanced microbiome can sneakily sabotage you with constant bloating, sluggish energy, and those stubborn extra pounds that you just can't lose no matter what. But here's the kicker. Fixing your gut bacteria isn't rocket science. It is the game changer for reclaiming your vibe and living your best damn life. And that is where Bioma steps in, delivering powerhouse supplements like their flagship probiotics for killer digestion and weight control, the Feminine Health Symbiotic to keep things balanced down there, and menopause support to crush hot flashes and mood swings. Their science-backed trio of prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics work like a gut reset button, all in vegan, tasteless capsules with a no BS 14-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it risk-free, okay? So go to gobioma.com/adultchild today for an extra 15% off your order. That is gobioma.com/adultchild and get an extra 15% off. All right, Shisha, so I have been talking to you about Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth, the supplement that helps women maintain optimal hormonal levels with over 50,000 glowing reviews from women worldwide, with 98% of them saying they would recommend it to somebody else. Now you can take those results even further by pairing it with their probiotic collagen protein, which helps restore gut lining integrity, promoting overall hormonal balance. It helps to relieve occasional bloating and gas, reduce sugar cravings. It helps you feel satisfied longer, boost your energy. It helps to relieve occasional gas and bloating, reduce sugar cravings, keeps you feeling satisfied longer, boost your energy, and helps you stabilize those damn mood swings. And because your gut directly affects your hormones, improving gut health can amplify your hormone harmony results so you can feel like yourself again. And so I struggle with brain fog. I'm sure many of y'all can relate. And since I've been taking the prebiotic collagen protein, obtain. I've noticed a big difference there, as well as just a lift in my overall energy levels. Happy Mammoth is dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows, folks. So right now, you can try prebiotic collagen protein and hormone harmony risk-free and get 15% off your entire first order today with code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That is happymammoth.com. Use code ADULTCHILD to get 15% off today.
So shit shows, the pressure to make the most of the final months of the year is absolutely real. If you woke up today thinking of all the things you should be doing, please stop shitting on yourself. You're doing the best that you can. And when the shoulds pile up for me, Calm is a tool that I reach for to release stress and find space to breathe even on my busiest days. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and it's here to help you feel better with guided meditations, sleep meditations, grounding exercises like breath work, and expert-led talks. The Calm app puts the tools you need right in your pocket, so stress and anxiety relief is always within reach. So calm your mind and change your life. Calm has an exclusive offer just for listeners of our show. Get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/adultchild. This is an amazing value. Go to calm.com/adultchild for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library, calm.com/adultchild, and tell Calm you heard about them from me.
You ask the best questions. You're just reminding me of my experience in our other conversation. They're so unique. It's so beautiful.
I'm just winging it, baby.
I know, but you're so embedded in the depth of the conversation.
We get deep here.
I love it. So yes, it does show up because you go back to thinking about that hybrid presentation. I'll say this. It shows up if you have an experience of a chronic fawn response, which is probably what adult children tend to have. It's where the term originates, right? It's sort of like, I'm still experiencing these things, these unmet needs, this residue from the past. So a chronic fawn response, if we go back to that hybrid idea, one half of that means I'm disconnected from self. Do I even know what it feels like to have my own back even when no one else is around? Do I have the sense of space and time and curiosity even in my own body to notice what am I actually experiencing? What do I actually feel? We are so habituated to the external environment or what other people might perceive us to be that we confuse that external mirror, as it were, for our true self. Our self is this false identity that is reflected back to us from the environment, right? It's that maybe the only self we've ever known. It was never safe enough to build internal safety, to be the center of your own skin and your own life, and to branch out from there. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it sneaks into every aspect of your life.
Let's talk about the sexual fawning.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that was something that you were, I know that you have personal experience, but was it something that was also showing up in working with clients and you felt like it wasn't getting the attention that it deserved or it wasn't?
Absolutely. I feel like sexual fawning was kind of couched in these other ways.
Maybe where you could define it in the way that you would define it.
Yes. Yeah, so if fawning is necessary when we are disempowered, right? You think about children, you think of systems of power. And I'll just use my personal experience. So I'm a child, I don't have any power in my home, and yet I'm being sexualized at the same time by my stepfather, right? So before I've had any sexual experience, even a first kiss, my body has a sense that, oh, the only power I actually have in the world resides in me being a sex object. Mm-hmm. Okay. Patriarchy supports this. All kinds of systems support this. So it's very common. I mean, you could probably look at the Me Too movement and point to sexual fawning all over the map. So the point being, now I go out in the world as I start to get older and I've inhabited myself as a sexual being. My body still remembers and knows that my essential currency in the world lies in my being attractive or appealing or sexual to you. And it would have me flirting with people that I was not remotely interested in, but sort of hoping to keep them at arm's length at the same time. There were lots of boundary violations. Most of my sexual experience was mired in what is very common in my clients' experiences, where we go, was I even experiencing pleasure? Do I even deserve pleasure? Because I'm completely oriented to what you're experiencing, even in terms of like, oh, I need to remember where their hand was on my body so tomorrow I could go and put my own hand there and see what they felt when their hand was on my body. Like, was that feeling good enough for them? Or did I feel lumpy or whatever? It's like we're completely oriented to the other person. I've heard so many stories on my couch. Like, you know, the second that I almost open this gate for people, they're like ready to go. They're holding these things and they go, I know what you're talking about, right? It's like, oh, maybe I was on my period, but I didn't want to like slow things down or have to run to the bathroom. And so I just didn't tell him about it. And I had sex with a tampon in. Like, there's just a million stories like that, right? It's like, I don't want to bum you out. I don't want to take care of myself and ask for protection because I'm not on birth control. And so, I get it. Yeah, that doesn't really feel good for you. And so if it doesn't feel good for you, well, guess I'm going to put myself in harm's way, right? We don't do this intentionally, but the fawn response is so wedded to sexuality in all of these ways, where particularly if it comes from childhood, you never had an opportunity to develop a natural, healthy sort of sexual development. It was robbed from you, right? It gets robbed from us just like our generosity and our empathy and our caretaking. All of these things are wonderful qualities to have, right? As is being a sexual person, we have bodies for a reason. But all of these things can be co-opted in the fawn response. And it's sort of like the body knows, oh, this is the thing that's going to get me in your good graces, right? So of course, sexuality is going to go right in that same vein.
Did fawning show up for you differently in romantic relationships compared to in friendships?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I am a monogamous person. And so the pressure I think that puts on like finding a partner and having them choose you back, even all the fairy tale idea around like being chosen and getting married. It's like, I tried so hard not to get swept up in all of that. But the truth is I was a bit on a mission, right? It was like, no. I'm going to be okay when I achieve these external markers of being okay. And so I think my fawn response was a bit on overdrive in the romance department for that reason. But similarly, in terms of not having access to a full self, you know, that showed up in all of my relationships. But I do feel fortunate that I do have some long-term friendships in particular that feel like, you know, they've known me since the beginning of time. And I don't feel like maybe there was as much damage there. But anywhere you could fawn, I've probably experienced
it. Well, okay, that brings up my next question is, how does fawning show up in parenting?
Girl, you are on fire. Okay, so one of the things that coincided with my losing my stepfather, which gave me more access to myself before I started writing my memoir about like, oh, wait a second, I feel safer on the planet now that he's gone. Let me go back and sort of revisit some of these things. What was happening alongside that is that I became a mom.
Yep.
And my son's very normal, typical sort of tantrums, like being a baby and then a toddler in the world, were deeply triggering to me. So one of the things that we're guarding against in a chronic fawn response is any conflict or upset at all. So his, like I said, normal, healthy upset, I didn't have a place to put it. It kind of blindsided me, to be honest. Here I was a therapist and I'd always thought I'd be such a great mom. And I was always the auntie and showing up for other people's kids and doing crafts and all the things. I was like Mary Poppins, right? But here I am in my own life with my own child in my house. And I'm like, I felt not only overwhelmed, but there was a part of me that it's so gross to admit, so hard to admit. I resented his ability to have access to the full range of human emotion, right? There was this like really primitive part of me that was almost like, it's my turn to be the adult and you should fawn for me, right? Mm-hmm. This was the feeling. So that's one way that it can come up in our parenting. And quite frankly, I think even a lot of parenting manuals can almost be teaching and fostering a fawn response under the guise of respect, right? You respect your elders, you know, we don't do this so much now, but those notions of like children should be seen and not heard. It's like there's a lot of that energy that can still be passed down and we're doing a disservice to our kids. There's that saying, children cannot regulate emotions they're not allowed to have. And the same is true for trauma survivors. It's like we're literally learning to experience and feel and communicate about these feelings maybe for the first time, which is why reparenting can be such an important part of a healing process. But the other way fawning can show up in parenting is just the like...
I would think on the opposite end of the spectrum, right? Like where you're like appeasing or you're not firm enough.
Exactly. You're not giving the kid any sense of personal responsibility. You're going to sort of run circles around them and clean up all the messes. And in a way, you're not giving them the opportunity to sort of step into their capacity and to know how to not only feel their feelings, but like be a person in the world that has other relationships, right? Because you're doing all the fixing and the caretaking and the appeasing for them. And it really cripples kids in a similar but different way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm curious, what did addressing fawning look like for you from a parts perspective?
Wow. It makes me think of a client that I talk about in the book because she refers to her little fawners, which are the lots of little fawning parts that came online, right? So we've already explored how fawning can show up differently depending on the context and in all these different ways. So I identify with this too, that I have different parts that fawn in different situations for different reasons, but they all have that same protective mechanism, right? That's their role is like, I'm going to keep Ingrid safe. Right. I'm going to get out ahead of this thing and I'm going to sort of fawn. But I love parts work generally for this, but specifically when we're looking at fawning, that it creates a little bit of distance between you and the behavior or you and the experience. And now suddenly I can relate to it differently and bring more awareness, more conscious awareness, more compassion. I love the notion in internal family systems of unburdening the parts, right? If a part really still feels like, no, I got to protect Ingrid, it's not going to stop that behavior, mm-hmm. which is also why some of the old stigmatizing and pathologizing terms, it's just, they don't meet us with that energy of going, oh my gosh, this part served such a vital purpose. And I'm going to honor that first and even thank the part and say, thank you so much. And do you see where I am in my life now? Do you see how old I am? Do you see the capacity that I have? Do you still want to do that job? You know, and sometimes the part's like, no, I want to go play. And then you can let it go and do that. But it creates more access and I think ownership. I love parts work for complex trauma generally, but for looking at fawning specifically, for sure.
Did you have any protectors where, because, you know, these parts are formed at such, you know, at younger points in time where we might think when we're like looking at it from our adult mind that we understand what it thinks that it's doing, but not really because it's not something that would come to our conscious mind. So I'm curious if there was anything there where like you were surprised at either like the role that it was playing or just some sort of a belief that maybe one of your parts had that was like a little, I don't know, like shocking. Yeah. Or
I mean, I can't come up with a specific example, but to your point, I think I'm always surprised. There is a very different experience between me, my adult self, and what my mind likes to tell me that it knows about a thing, right? It's like, I'm going to figure it out, right? I'm going to analyze it and I'm going to break it down. Almost every time when I'm working from an experiential or somatic or parts place, the wisdom of the body, the wisdom of these parts, boy, they are so much smarter than my conscious present tense mind, and they have a lot to teach me. So this is one of the hardest things, but one of the best things, that when I see my clients kind of get out of their own way in this way of like, I'm going to figure it out and I'm smart enough and oh, no, I know already. It's like, we don't. Let's put that on the shelf and restore this deeper gut place wisdom, right? The gut being sort of your second brain. I think it's way smarter than the thing walking around on our shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when it comes to like addressing fawning, we've talked about parts work and that being so important, but I would imagine, and from reading in the book, like this has to be done on a nervous system level. This isn't something where, okay, now I understand why I do this, so I'm going to be able to stop doing this.
Correct. Yeah. I think understanding takes us a fair amount of the way, right? Understanding can diminish the shame, which oftentimes one of the biggest barriers to healing is the shame. So I think, you know, that sort of takes us halfway down the road. But yes, I think if you're looking to work with a therapist, at the very bare minimum, they need to be trauma informed. But I would say the preference is always that they are trauma trained. And that means they have at least one, if not a couple or several specific modalities for working with relational trauma. And there are too many to name, you know, so I hesitate to go there. I only share the experience in the book from my practice. So it's related to internal family systems, somatic experiencing, and EMDR, but there are so many modalities out there, but it tends to be crucial to your point, right? Because you can't fix an unconscious response with the conscious mind. It speaks two different languages. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how long have you been married to your husband now?
11 years.
11 years. Okay. Yeah. When did you start your childhood trauma healing journey?
Well, it depends on
like when complex trauma.
Yeah. Well, I actually think what started me really on that was leaving my first marriage.
Yeah.
Because I had never broken up with anyone I had ever dated before leaving my first marriage. I stayed and I hoped and I waited and I was helpful, right? I was chronic fawn all over the place. But finding the ability to walk away from my first marriage that was not working, to say, I'm finally going to stop waiting for you to choose me back and I'm just going to choose me, was crucial. And I think if I hadn't have done that, I would not have been available for someone like Yancey, who I'm married to now, right? So it wasn't like nothing was happening before, but he and I were married. And like I said, we had our son, Henry, when really my world shattered. And I found myself at this very table at 3 o'clock every morning, pouring out my story over my memoir for years at a time, you know? And the amazing thing was, is that every time, God, this is going to make me emotional. Every time I would like shake my fist at the sky or be like, what am I doing this for? This is like crazy making. What, I could not understand why this was happening. I certainly wasn't getting any support or like couldn't find an agent or no one really cared about it. I'm like, then take this thing away from me, this obsession. It just felt so crippling. And my husband would hear me and watch me shake my fist and hear me say, I'm not going to keep doing this. And he would just love me and go, mm-hmm. And then the next morning I'd be like, okay, I got to keep going. And he's like, I know you do. You know, and he just trusted my process when I was so in the weeds and I didn't know which way was up. And I'm so grateful to him for that. And he even saw this fawning book long before I could ever see it. Midway through my memoir, he's like, you're a writer, you know, and you're going to write another book. And I was like, no, what would I write about? You know, you're out of your mind. And to be that seen and supported and loved by someone is like beyond.
Huge.
Yeah.
Are you an anxious attacher or were you?
Yes. I think I'm all of the attachment styles, right? Depending. And I will be honest and say, I never really connected with that language either. So it's not like I think in attachment styles, but you could lay the attachment styles probably directly over this, you know, looking at trauma responses and complex trauma. It's because, you know, we're talking about the same thing. It's just different words.
I was just curious about like what your experience was in dating him, like in those earlier days. Nice. Because you had this, yeah, like you realized you had a broken picker, which you realized eventually was trauma. But what did that look like? Was that like a nerve-wracking experience for you or confusing. Was this different?
It was very different, which is what made it so confusing. I knew that I wanted something radically different, but I had no blueprint for it, right? And so whereas pretty much every relationship prior to meeting him had that like crazy chemistry, that
right
sort
off the bat,
of festive
yeah.
feeling, right?
Yeah.
I did not have that with Yancey. I had one of the loveliest conversations, present, ease, interesting, smart, like it was just all there, but it because it didn't have that fiery sort of like, yeah, fuse that was slowly burning down. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, maybe we're just meant to be friends, right? Because I just truly did not know what it felt like to be in a healthy reciprocal relationship. And then of course I started to overanalyze and I was like, well, wait a second.
Yeah, trying to find things wrong with him.
Yes, he clearly must not be right for me. And I found the things that I found. And fortunately, I turned to this amazing friend and mentor at the time. And I was like, I don't know. I think I'm doing it all over again. And he said, Ingrid, you were always trying to make the wrong person right. And now you're trying to make the right person wrong.
Mm.
And when he said it, my body just knew that it was true. And it's almost like in that moment, I let go of trying to figure it out. And I allowed myself to be in this relationship with him and to experience something brand new. And it was just this funny thing where it still felt like it was just so easy. It's to this day, the easiest relationship of my life. I've never questioned it. I've never questioned either of our loyalty or commitment. We've never lied to one another. I mean, the foundation is just rock, rock solid. I trust it so completely. But at first it just felt like that thing that I would tell clients, like, well, do you want to see him again? You know? And it was like, yeah, I can't wait to see him again. And so I just trusted that, right? And it built from there.
How has fawning showed up in your relationship with him?
You know, that's another great question. I think because I had never felt so safe, he gets a lot of the crispy underbelly that I wouldn't allow anyone else to experience, right? So if it's not safe for me to be a whole person in the world, but I have all of this like churning stuff, guess
the
who gets
crispy underbelly. I love it.
So the good news is that he's the kindest person I know, but he also doesn't take any shit. And he has a way of reflecting back to me when I'm, I don't know, either nitpicking him and sort of tearing him apart, or when I'm being, I don't know, when I'm bringing stuff to him that isn't his. He has this way of making me see it and almost laugh at the absurdity. And then we can both sort of be together and how ridiculous it all is. I hope that that's changing over time, that the more that I can be more of myself in all the places, the less I have to dump on him at home. Do you know what I mean? He certainly deserves that. And I'm committed to that ongoing work. But I think that that's changed over time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to follow up, like go a little bit deeper on a few of the things that we touched upon in your first interview.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about you going no contact with your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on a conscious level, we can understand that our parents' inability to take accountability or have a willingness to do the work, like, has nothing to do with us not being good enough or lovable enough obviously, like, there's younger parts of us, though, that, you know, probably think that it does have to do with that. And so I was curious if you could touch upon that and what did grieving that look like for you?
Wow. So in the years and years of writing my memoir, I was hyper-focused on my stepdad, and my mom was still kind of getting a free pass, right? It was easier to see him for the abuser that he was, but I had a real hard time owning the depth of her neglect.
It's and coming to terms with, like, the safer parent.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, this is what was so interesting about writing too, and maybe we talked about this before. As I was finishing what I at that point knew was going to be a memoir on my experience, I kept having to look at my story through the reader's eyes, right? And through the reader's eyes, it's like, mom is missing, right? But it was only for the sake of the reader, quite frankly. It was not because I was finally ready. It was like, oh my God, this story is not finished. I have to look at this. Mm-hmm. And having to look at it was the most devastating experience of my life, to finally feel and metabolize and feel the shattering of what had always been true, but that I had continued to kind of rise above it and dress it up and, you know, make it something else. To finally own that was so brutal. And it dropped me into what was a very real need to have no contact, because contact would have meant that I was still in harm's way, right? So it's almost like I was carrying all this wounding and I never really knew it. But now that I do, and I see that I'm essentially this gaping wound with not so much as a Band-Aid to hold it together, I needed to shore up a sense of safety, like my life depended on it. And safety meant I cannot be in relationship with people that have harmed me. And that, to your point, by not taking responsibility, by not admitting what happened, by not validating to, like, the tiniest degree, it's like there was a very low bar, but by not doing any of that, you are perpetuating that very harm. And no contact became almost like this, you know, me cobbling together the only safety net I'd ever known, right? And, you know, what does grieving look like?
Before you go there, what did that conversation with her look like when you finally set that boundary? Well, and so basically, just to recap too, yeah, even though people probably will have, like, reheard your story, but you initially, and if I'm remembering correctly, you initially came to your mom about the abuse when you were younger, 16. Correct?
Yeah.
And how old? 16. And then once your stepfather passed away, you circled back to her on that with kind of a false hope that maybe that now that he's gone, she'll be willing to look at this.
Yes, because I'd endowed her for all of those years, those decades, with some sense of real.
She's married to this man.
Yes, she was married to him the whole time.
Yep.
And I really believed that she knew what happened, but quite frankly was in her own fawn response, where her privileging her relationship with this man not only involved self-abandonment, she abandoned her kids, right? Not able to show up for them and advocate for them when we were literally asking for help. And so I did believe, as he passed away and I felt safer, even though he was hundreds of miles away, I didn't have much of a relationship with him. I felt safer in the world. And I imagined maybe she feels safer too. Maybe we can finally have a real relationship. It was, of course, what I'd always wanted. Who doesn't want that, right? But I knew we couldn't have it unless we finally addressed the elephant in the room, which is that she told me I made it all up, and that I was a selfish liar and it didn't really happen. And
did you ever speak about it with her again between 16 until this conversation? No. Okay.
I don't believe so. I don't have any memory of it. Nope. I went into, like, okay, you're not available for that, but this is my family, and so I'm going to go along to get along, and it's just going to be the elephant in the room, and I'm going to tolerate it, right? Like, I'm going to deal with your lack of seeing me, respecting me, honoring me at all. I'm going to see my abuser at my wedding, at all these family functions, because that's what it means to have a family, right? It's like I'm constantly attached to my greatest pain and wounding. And so at the end of the day, I did circle back, and she had just lost her husband of decades. So she was not able to have that conversation. And the fawner in me goes, well, I can wait a little
bit longer. Give it time, baby. Give it some time.
3 decades or more. Surely that's not enough. Like, now she's grieving. And so I circled back again. And, you know, through various means, and if people are interested, read the memoir, because it's all in there. But at the end of the day, she just wasn't able to do it, right? And so I don't even know that it was, I had said prior, if we can't have a real conversation, I cannot have you in my life. But I don't know that there was another moment where I was like, well, here's the moment, right? Like, you're incapable. It was just like, I cannot do this. I cannot. In fact, I sent a text. That's what it was, because something had happened. And I was like, psh, that's it, right? I'm not going to keep pretending. You can't keep pretending like we have this happy family life. None of it's real. Do not contact me.
And did she respond?
I think it was her response to that that was, you know, a response that a lot of us get, which is like, I can't change the past. And we all make mistakes. And I'm like, but I don't recall you mentioning any mistakes that you've actually made, right? And I'm not asking you to change the past. I'm actually asking you to show up differently now. But it was just, it was a reflection of the same thing dressed up in language that someone might have perceived as like, I love you. In fact, you know, I want to have a relationship. I love you. But there was no there, right? And so that was it. And, you know, it was several years like that. And meanwhile, my son's getting older, and that feels more complicated, and all of things that we have to go through along those lines. But what also was happening is I was working with a brilliant trauma therapist and doing more of this work and working more with my clients, which always reinforces my own understanding and healing. And it's like those young parts of me that could not tolerate a mother who never protected me, they finally know that I'm here. I'm here. I can protect us in ways that I was not capable of before, but I don't feel that vulnerable, that much of a raw nerve, honestly, to anyone, right? It's like I finally have skin. And now that I have skin, my boundaries have shifted a bit. And I have seen her with my son for my son's sake specifically. We have revisited the conversation. And basically she said, well, she read my memoir and she told a friend that she believed me. So that was one step in the process. She didn't tell me, but she told a friend who told me. And when I tried to have the conversation again, not too long ago, she cannot do it. She cannot have the conversation. And then I said, well, then I'm going to have to close this door again. And she said, but I can listen. I can listen. And so I said every single thing you can possibly imagine in a tone that you can also imagine. And I said all of the things, and particularly now as a mom with a child and imagining him coming to me for help and my not only not giving it to him, but like making him the bad guy. I said it all, and she heard it, and she admitted I was a bad mom and I didn't do right by you. And she said a lot of other things that felt a little like, ugh, you still don't get it. But she showed up to the degree that she could. And then she said, you know, can you please, 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 please forgive me? And in that moment, I really searched my body and I was like, I can. I can. It doesn't mean we're like hanging out or, you know, having regular conversations. She knows about this book. I said, you know what? At the end of the day, I can forgive you and you never have to talk about it. But you need to know that I'm never going to stop, because talking about it has saved my life and returned me to me, and it's helping other people. And so, you know, this is the reality now. And she said, I get it. And I'm proud of you. And I don't want you to stop. So little inroads.
It's, yeah. And it just like goes to show, just shame is so like mind blowing and baffling.
That's right.
Just how we will, we're willing, some people are, would rather lose a relationship with a child,
yeah,
than face the shame of themselves. And I know it's not a conscious
right
choice,
right,
but it just go the mental gymnastics that go on, just how powerful like the brain is,
yeah,
that it will convince someone that it's cutting off your child is the better option,
yeah,
between looking at the ways you screwed up.
But I don't even think she would ever say cutting off my child, even though I flat out said, you're the one who's making this decision by not engaging.
Losing a relationship with the child.
Yes. In her mind, she's thinking, well, gosh, Ingrid just can't get over this. I hope she gets over it one day, you know?
Yes. Yeah, I just came across this like woman's Instagram who she's like taking like the opposite approach of how kids that cut off their parents are so entitled and bratty, and the first time that you say no to your kids, then they cut you off. And I'm like, wow, this is like a huge marketplace,
yes,
for gassing up all these parents, yes, who just won't like take accountability for the ways, yes, that they screwed up. I was like, oh, I had to do everything in me to not like comment on it.
It's such a shame. But to be honest, you know, as a part of like marketing this fawning book, there was a big piece in the New York Times that my book was included in. And the title of the article was, is self-help just turning everyone into being a jerk? Right. I'm paraphrasing, but that was literally the title. And again, it just misses the mark. It's like, am I entitled? Am I a jerk? Or am I finally just feeling like the effects of what happened to me? Am I trying to have a voice for the first time? Am I trying to do the thing that y'all have been telling me to do my whole life, which is set a healthy boundary? Mm-hmm. But you want me to set a healthy boundary that doesn't ruffle any of your feathers. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's just not how it works. And so I think it's easy to couch it in that way, that it's about entitlement. And again, I go, this is similar for people that cannot wrap their heads around a fawn response. They're just like, that's not even a thing. And what are you talking about? And it's just manipulation or whatever they want to say. And I go, you know what you're telling me right now is that you've never been disempowered a day in your life. And God bless you. I'm so glad that you have no clue what I am even talking about. And don't you dare tell me what my experience has been, or judge it if you have not walked one single day in my shoes.
Hell yes.
Yeah.
I want to circle back to the group. Obviously you have somewhat of a relationship with your mom now, but I am curious what the grieving looked like as far as coming to terms.
Did I skip over that?
Yeah. Andrea? I'm circling back.
Did I sort of?
No, it's okay. We're meandering.
Oh goodness.
Let me just say this first before, yeah, like, so one thing that I've really been coming to terms with over the past several months for me, yeah, is I realize how much me intellectualizing,
yes,
my parents is really cutting me off from experiencing just like the deep sadness of the reality of the situation with my parents.
You said it better than I could say, right? Is that real grieving means dropping into just the reality, the painful reality, not figuring it out or understanding it or riding on top of the experience because I'm going to pack it in all this like clinical language or whatever. And, you know, when I was writing the memoir, and shortly after I had this evidence that like even all these years later, my mom was in fact not going to say, oh my God, I'm so sorry that happened and let's have a real conversation. That feeling, that very vulnerable, primitive, wounded, oh my God, the person that's supposed to love me dropped me and is essentially saying they would do it again. Like, I mean, it just, there was no pain like that pain. And I remember two things. One, sleeping next to Yancey as it was like the grief was coming for me. And I was like, no, I don't want to feel this. It's like I was willing myself not to feel it and it wouldn't let me run this time. And the feeling of lying next to, the contrast, in other words, of lying next to the person that was holding more space and more love for me than I'd ever held my entire life. and yet feeling this feeling of the mother wound coming for me, being like, you never really mattered to begin with. It was like, I felt like, talk about shame. I mean, it was just, I felt slimed. I felt mired in this goo that was like, even my husband must not be real. I'm not meant for this world. I mean, it just sucks you in. It sucked me into a very dark place. And I did not want him to know that I was feeling it. I didn't want him to see me cry. I felt not ugly physically, but there was like this too ugly for the world kind of a thing, right? And I had to like slink quietly out of bed and go into the bathroom and sob like I hadn't sobbed my entire life until there was no energy left, right? And so that was one big scene, one big moment. But talk about the millions of moments in between. Talk about the moment of me selling this book, fawning, right? I went from deciding that I'm going to validate my own story and I'm going to self-publish my memoir. And it was the most healing and helpful thing I'd ever done. Fast forward, and I'm sitting in 14 different meetings with major publishers. And they're all like, Ingrid, we want you to write this book on fawning. And I was in London for a conference when I got the news that Penguin Random House was, you know, basically taking the book off the table before anyone else could scoop it up. And I'm sitting on the plane coming home. And that feeling when you have a parent that's alive, but you can't really call him and tell him, like, I did this thing. That's another moment of grief, right? That's another moment of grief. My son goes through things where I go, God, as a parent, right? It's so lonely sometimes as a parent, but to not be able to reach back to that other link in the chain and be like, hey, I'm going through this thing. I could use the support. There's just countless and countless moments and opportunities where I have to pause and slow down. And so even coming back from London, I had to open my laptop and I was like writing a letter to myself and feeling all the feelings. And when that became too much, I had to go in the, you know, the airplane bathroom and have a huge sob and sort of just like come back to the seat and keep going, right? So it's this ongoing process. This type of grief is like every other kind of grief when you're talking about loss, where you think you're doing just fine. And then out of nowhere, you just get this blow, right? And it's often in these unusual circumstances, you're like, well, I thought it would happen here, but boy, it's really caught me off guard. So, you know, weathering the storms of these grief patterns that move through my system is a big part of the ongoing process of healing. And new memories arise, even that I didn't know about from before. Other parts, you know, the longer I do this parts work, boy, they are holding some history and some wisdom that I can understand why I forgot, you know, I can understand.
Anything you'd be willing to share? Something that's popped up recently?
No, I'm not going to go there yet. It's not too fresh. Metabolized enough. And I still only have fragments, so it wouldn't feel fair to what I feel like is emerging. But I'm going to trust the process that's emerging. I'm going to trust this process and the parts, just like I trusted the writing that came before, and know that my life is dedicated to this process of reclaiming me and taking care of myself, whatever that looks like.
I really, that what you spoke to about when you were flying back from London, like that, I can relate to it. And I know so many people can, of that unique pain that comes from having your parents have a disinterest, like in your life, you know, like there's something that's very, it really, really hits the gut.
Yeah. And I think I didn't even know those things really. I hadn't felt them really until I started writing them about them in the memoir. And then I could see like, oh yeah, you never came to see me at college or where I lived, or, you know, I moved across the country and you never came to see me there. Oh, I got a PhD and you didn't come to graduation, you know, all of these things. And so fast forward to this moment of like selling the book, and it's just, you're not just feeling the grief of that moment. You're feeling it for a lifetime of those experiences, where here you are doing it alone in this way again, right? Obviously, I had my friends and my husband, but it's different. It's different.
Well, I'm so proud of you. And you're such a beautiful example of like the reality, the hard truth of this messy ass healing journey that we're on. Unfortunately, folks, it never ends.
Yeah.
And that's good.
But it does get better, wouldn't you say? I mean,
yes.
if it didn't also return me to me in ways that, like, I couldn't have written this book. Are you kidding me? I'm proud of myself. I'm proud of this work that I'm putting into the world. This feels like it blows my mind that my life has led up to my ability to do this. You know, you talk about that fawning presentation where I don't want to be too big because I'm a target. It's like, oh my gosh, can I get over how big I am in my life right now? And I'm still terrified. There are parts of me that are like, what's the blowback gonna be? But I know without a doubt that the richness and the community and the goodness and the healing is going to be so much bigger than anything else that could ever come for me. And even if it does, I have my own back. I know who I am. I know my intentions. I know that I'm not saying I have it all figured out. I'm saying, can we just have this aspect of the conversation already? This is just my contribution, right? So it almost doesn't matter even if someone does come for me, because I'm going to be able to say, like, okay, well, what's about you in that, you know? Not just own it, like, oh, I'm bad, I did something wrong.
Yeah, heaven forbid we consider that maybe it has nothing to do with us.
And us at all, that's right.
Well, on behalf of all the fawners out there, thank you so much for writing this book. Is there anything about this book that you want to share that I haven't asked?
No, you asked the best questions. Thank you for unpacking this even more. I mean, I feel like even this conversation gives me a chance to sort of know myself more, to love myself more. And you give that to your listeners. It's a huge gift what you do. I'm so glad you're back.
And I want to give you kudos to the amazing work that you're doing on behalf of being a mom too. So.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Let it all go. What's making you slow now? Let it all go.